Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our latest batch of listener questions. Today we're looking at how underage players sign contracts. We're asking if Bayer Leverkusen belong among the all-time greats. And we're asking why Luton's Rob Edwards isn't more in demand. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today to solve your mysteries, our soccer sleuth Taylor Rockingwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, man. That is an esoteric beginning to an episode of the Total Soccer Show. It's Leverkusen's greatness, and then one specific question about Luton's manager. There will be more broad questions, but I'm excited to answer those and more.
Are you proud of me for not mentioning how handsome Luton's manager is at the outset, Taylor? Even though I've just done that now.
So handsome.
I mean, I feel like that's a backdoor way of doing it. So no is my answer, but also yes at the same time.
Wonderful stuff. Speaking of so handsome, Graham Ruthven's here, whose wife says he looks like Josh Hartnett, and I agree with her.
Thanks, Ryan Bailey. She says, just to clarify, she says that Josh Hartnett is the more handsome version of me, which feels like a backhanded compliment. Just to clarify exactly what she said. But nobody is as handsome as Rob Edwards, the Luton Town manager. Social media, I don't know if anyone has noticed, social media is extremely thirsty for Rob Edwards.
Yeah.
To such an extent that every single interview that he does, and Luton Town, they know exactly what's up now. They're clipping out every single interview. It gets retweeted and favorited like thousands upon thousands of times just purely because of Rob Edwards' handsomeness.
There was a point, Graham, earlier in this season where I believe young TikTok discovered him and his oeuvre, and it became a thing. It became a thing for a few weeks, definitely. That was very amusing. Joining us also, Joe Lowry. Hello, Joe.
Hello,
Speaking
Ryan.
Of young TikTok.
I guess that's me. I have to concur with all the chat that's happened so far. Both the Graham comp, the Rob Edwards discussion, all of this tracks.
It does indeed. Plenty of listener questions to get to on this episode. TotalSoccerShow.com/questions if you'd like to drop us one. Another way to ask us a question via our Discord, which you can access on the Patreon, patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow. If you love this show and you'd like to support it, thank you very much to everyone who does so. patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow for bonus episodes, for videos, and aforementioned access to Discord where we chat good. Real good, Joe. Real good.
Worse. Real good.
Yes. Very enjoyable. Shall we get to it? Why don't we start off the listener questions? Jordan Rowe has been in touch. I love this question. I'm going to start again. And I love it so much, I'm going to say it properly this time. If you could go back in history to experience one season or tournament as one of the players, coaches, or referees involved, which season or tournament would you go back to experience? For example, says Jordan, as Maradona in the 86 World Cup, Gio Reyna at the last World Cup, or Jamie Vardy during Leicester's title season. Taylor, I'm going to come straight out of the bat here. My pick is Emi Martinez at the 2022 World Cup. A man having the time of his life. Just to do the glove thing. Like the most poop housing we've arguably ever seen in a final. Maybe besides some headbutts a few years back. But, you know, hero of the penalty shootout, saving a few via massive poop housery. The glove thing. Having a time of his life, that's my nomination. I want to be Emmy.
For those who don't remember, and maybe myself, can you explain the glove thing?
He got the golden glove, did he not, at the end of the tournament? Yep. And he posed with it in a way that the host nation were not best pleased with, I would say.
It was unbecoming of a World Cup winner, shall we say. My favourite thing about it is whoever the Qatari official is behind him staring on in disgust at what he's doing to the glove.
Even the Qatar ghost mascot was very shocked and appalled by those actions. Ryan, I'm assuming that you reverse engineered it back from that moment was hilarious to me. I would like to do that on a global stage. But he did also have a good tournament, right? Let me go check. And then he did, and I'm guessing that's how you landed upon that answer?
I did, yeah. Also, he won the World Cup, which is pretty good. But also, like, that shootout where he forced Tchouaméni to miss after, like, throwing the ball away moments before he was going to kick it. I think it was it Kingsley Coman? Yeah. He saved the shot from as well after doing some poop housery before that as well. He was on it. He was up to 11, Emi Martinez.
Right at the end of extra time as well, he makes arguably the most consequential save in football history, where he saves from Colomwani, who's 1-1.
No, you're right.
And, yeah, that and Argentina win it in the shootout. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a good shout. But mainly for the poop housery, though, rather than the sporting excellence.
Would you all be surprised to learn that I struggled with this question and got way too into the weeds on how this would work?
You?
Because I'm like, is this like an Assassin's Creed video game thing where if I stray too far from the actual timeline, do I have to reset? Am I living as this person? Is it me trying to play as this person? Is it Ryan actually in goal? Does Ryan have to do Emmy Martinez things? Are you on autopilot? How did it work for you, Ryan? Or were these not things that you were concerned about?
Well, the question says you experience it as one of the players. Mm-hmm. So I become Emmy Martinez in my mind. He is not me. I am him.
Mm-hmm. But do you then have the option of not doing that celebration, or are you fate bound to doing it? Now we're getting into philosophy.
I envision this as being fate bound. Like I try to imagine myself basically just sort of coexisting in their minds and sort of like being along for the ride while they're still doing all of the professional soccer stuff that I don't know how to do.
Right,
that's like the very light framework that I used. Taylor, I do appreciate that you went in deeper, though.
I'll say, Taylor, we're adopting Donnie Darko rules, where the fate path, the light energy is already coming out of our chest. Our path has been determined.
It's like when the battery runs out in your PlayStation controller when you're playing FIFA and the game just decides it's going to play for you.
Yeah.
But you're still in it somehow.
Somehow both of yours made it less clear than Joe's.
Let's go.
My answer, I have two, not surprisingly, because one is maybe slightly too nerdy even for me. But my first one, the first came to mind, is Steve McClaren for the end of the 1999 Manchester United season. You take over after Brian Kidd has left and Sir Alex Ferguson is annoyed, but you get to work with Fergie, you get to conduct training, you win the treble, you bring about modernization in the club, and you see how he had that impact. And I think it would be interesting to see the ins and outs of training with a very intense manager and a very intense team and how they kind of kept it together to win the treble. That would be fascinating to me. But ultimately, the younger child in me came out in this one. It's Leo Messi in 2009. That's the one for me. Score a goal in the final of the Champions League against Manchester United, which would be, I don't know, interesting for me. But you get to like kind of cement your legend. I believe it's Pep's first full season in charge, or first season in charge. You win a treble as well. But to be sort of like the central figure of a team that becomes legendary and yourself becomes legendary, I think would be a very cool experience to ride along for.
Those are two quite diametrically opposed choices, I would argue.
That
Taylor, you've gone for the glory, and then, like, of all the people you could have chosen in 99 at Man United, you went for Steve McClaren.
Well, this is where I went with that one. That's a fair point. Is that I think I would not want to be in Sir Alex Ferguson's brain. I feel like that might be too much for me. But to see how he worked, and I do feel like there was probably, I don't know, like an abusive stepdad vibe going on there of like screaming at you and then putting an arm around you and being like, hey, you're doing great, son. I think it would just be interesting to see how a knighted manager, not yet knighted, but soon to be knighted manager, operated. But I think how he managed that team that had potential egos, but also a lot of ruthlessness in it. I don't think I would want to be one of the players. I think it would be interesting to be able to sort of be secondary in that one and see how it all worked.
You want a front row seat, basically.
Exactly.
To one of the greatest triumphs in football history. Yeah. Steve McClaren was also on my list, but not for 1999 treble, but for the season where he failed to take England to a major tournament in 2008.
Umbrella in hand. Graham goes in. Well
the Wally
done.
With a brolly.
Yeah. Well done, Graham. Very
That's
good.
My favorite answer Graham's ever given. I knew where that was going, Graham? As soon as you said it.
It was too easy.
2007.
Thanks to
the
alley
it was.
Oh,
my
God. 2007, yeah. That's so my mind went to Greece at Euro 2004, which until Leicester winning the Premier League, I think was the biggest upset in modern soccer history. The reason I still think it would be more fun to have been in that Greece team is that what a major tournament is so condensed, right? So while Leicester was undeniably a huge upset, they had a full season to contemplate what they were doing. Whereas Greece winning Euro 2004 unfolds over 3 weeks. They went from rank outsiders to winning the whole thing in that period of time. And the player that I always remember from that tournament is Angelos Charisteas, who scores the winner in the final. I just think it would have been exhilarating to go from being a player playing at a decent level. He was at Werder Bremen at the time of that tournament, but you wouldn't say he was a household name. And in the space of that month, he goes from that sort of player to being a superstar. And I can't imagine how much of a buzz that must have been. He scored against Spain, France and Portugal in that tournament. His goal against Portugal was the winner in the final against the host nation. Greece also played and won the opening game of that tournament. And then afterwards, Charisteus just sort of like resumes his career at a middling level, and the whole thing is just a memory. So yeah, I bet that that month was pretty fun for him. So I would like to be him for the duration of Euro 2004.
It's very hard for me to listen to that answer, the totality of that answer, and not hear it as you mocking England and then trying to find a way to believe that Scotland could win the Euros this summer. Because it does feel like that's kind of the picture you're painting here.
Yeah, swap out Charisteus for Lyndon Dykes, and you're in my mind with this question.
That is a sentence that I assure you has never been said in the history of the Total Soccer Show. Congratulations, Graham. Well done.
Thanks.
I was lucky enough to be in Lisbon at the time of that final. I wasn't at the gate or anything. But let's just say the Greeks were very happy. The Portuguese were very, very, very unhappy with the scenario that unfolded.
Were they all crying like Cristiano Ronaldo?
Something like that. Yeah, indeed. Fun times to be had by some at the Euro 2004. Joe, where did you go with this one?
So I really like Jordan's Gio Reyna shout, to be honest, if only so that I don't have to do too much running and training. Like, that feels ideal. I don't know how that fits into the framework that I tossed out earlier, but it feels like I'm going to be less tired than everyone else, and I like that. That's not my ultimate answer. I have two other choices, and they're both very much moments-based. I'm going to the 2014 World Cup to start with Robin van Persie. I want to experience that leaping header. Like, that for me is sort of like this... it's one of the moments that's etched in stone in my mind, the Netherlands taking on Spain in that World Cup. It's one of the coolest goals I've ever seen, and it really just captivated me when I watched it in the moment, sort of very, very early on in my own personal soccer life/journey. I hated that sentence, but people get the idea. That is just such an iconic moment in my own mind, and I think in the minds of others as well. It's a really, really great goal. The other moment that I think would be very, very cool to experience, I'm going to the 1999 Women's World Cup. And I would like to sort of just hang out with Brandi Chastain, like, I guess, in the mind of Brandi Chastain, scoring that World Cup winning penalty against China in the shootout in 99 in front of a crowd at the Rose Bowl with 90,000 people in it. That had never been done for not just a women's soccer game, but for a women's sporting event. Like, that has got to be one of the coolest events to have attended and to have been a part of, like, ever in sports. And getting to be a part of that penalty kick and the celebrations, I mean, that's... It's just a really, really awesome moment in American soccer history, and getting to like actually be involved in that moment would have been awesome.
I love it. Two excellent answers there, Joe, but I think all of us have missed the actual correct answer here, which is Scott Carson in any Man City season of late. Man City really, third choice goalkeeper is the best job in sports. Yeah. Zero pressure, all the glory, all the money, surely. Is that not the best job in sports? Has to
no,
be, right?
No, I think my dad's always talked about how being the backup or third string quarterback in the NFL is like always the way to go. This is a very similar theory. Yeah. Ryan, I'm all about this. This is like my Gio Reyna at the 2022 World Cup theory to the max. Like, dude, what are you doing, man? Like, you're like hanging out in training, like saving a few shots for fun and like cracking jokes. It sounds pretty good.
Yeah, not bad at all. All right, thank you very much indeed, Jordan, for that question. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're talking by Leverkusen. Back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Clay W has been in touch. Clay Dubs says, Leverkusen could set the Bundesliga single season record if they keep going, and they could also win the Europa League and the DFB Pokal if they win all three competitions. Is this the greatest non-Champions League team in the current 32-team format Champions League era? And I'll just note that Steve McCarry also asked a similar question. He was a first-time question asker. Graham, I found a couple of comparable teams to Bayer Leverkusen. The closest one I think I could find was Porto in 2010-11. They went undefeated for a 30-game season. They won the Europa League, the Taça de Portugal, and the Super Cup that season. So that's kind of comparable. Also, your boys in Glasgow Celtic, 2016-17, won the league, the Scottish Cup and the League Cup, and were undefeated also. But I'm not sure how either of those two teams would stand up to the mighty current Leverkusen.
Yeah, I have trouble with this question for a number of reasons. I'm not entirely sure if we're talking about the standard of the team or the standard of the like the achievement, because I would argue that like Liverpool this season aren't in the Champions League, right? So this season you would class them as a non-Champions League team. If we're talking about the standard of the team, they might be among the best in Europe this season. But I kind of went down the line of achievements rather than the standard of the team, so this might be the obvious answer in that regard, but I still think Leicester City winning the Premier League outweighs Leverkusen winning three trophies in one season. The other one that comes to mind is Aberdeen, going all the way back to 1983. Now, I know that's outside the Champions League era that Clay mentions, but still, I have to push forward my Aberdeen agenda. They won the European Cup Winners' Cup that season. For all that Alex Ferguson did at Man United, that was, in my mind, his single greatest achievement. Aberdeen beat Real Madrid in the final. The team that they beat in the quarterfinals, Bayern Munich. A Scottish team, certainly not one outside the Old Firm. They'll never do anything like that ever again. And Aberdeen also won the Scottish Cup that year. They beat Celtic in the semi-final and then Rangers in the final. So that's all very impressive. I realise I'm stretching bending the parameters of this question. My next one, my final one, isn't really a single season, but Sevilla winning the Europa League 5 times in 10 seasons is sort of ridiculous. They won it 3 times in a row between 2014 and 2016. And for a club that isn't one of the elite to do that, I know it's not the Champions League, but still, that's pretty incredible for one club to have a hold over a competition like that. But yeah, I struggled with kind of clarifying, defining the question. If we're talking about the standard of team, then Liverpool this season has to be a shout. Arsenal last season weren't in the Champions League when they led the title race for the majority of the season. That might be recency bias, but those are two teams that come to the top of my mind.
Yeah, Graham, I think you're spot on there with your line of thinking. I also like how you started talking faster when you mentioned Aberdeen for fear that Ryan would cut you off mid-sentence. That's just smart play on your part, frankly. This is the problem, right? So the modern Champions League era is from 1992 to now. The 32-team group stage started in 2000. So there's 24 years of teams between now and then. The brutal reality is that as time has gone on, the Premier League has created a larger and larger distance between itself and the rest of the soccer world, not just the rest of Europe, but certainly the other top leagues in Europe, to the point where now, even a very, very good Bayer Leverkusen team, I think that team would be in a very nice, comfortable position in the Premier League right now. But would they be competing for the title with Liverpool, Arsenal, and Man City? I am skeptical, as it seems like you are as well, Graham. It's a really difficult situation. Undefeated seasons, though, at the same time, don't happen very often. And Ryan, you mentioned one of them. We had a listener questions about a question about this not too long ago. Obviously, Arsenal's invincible team is probably the most famous example in this millennium. You've got Rangers a few years ago, Celtic a few years before that. Ryan, you mentioned Porto. Juve did it in 11-12. The last time it happened in Germany was in the early 1980s. It was with Berliner FC Dynamo in East Germany back in the 1982 season. Like, it's been a long time. So I don't want to detract from what Leverkusen have done, but I do think relative league strength makes it very difficult to paint this team as maybe the highest quality team outside of the Champions League in the modern era. That said, they're better than Leicester City. Not that you're denying that, Graham, but they're, I think, higher quality than most, but maybe not all.
Okay. Taylor, take us home with some Leverkusen praise, please.
I will, because I'll say I think the Leicester shout is a very good shout. I think 2011 Porto, you mentioned them briefly, Ryan, is the primary contender for me, given that they go undefeated, as you mentioned, given everything they win. But the way they win the league as well, they win it by 21 points over Benfica. No losses, 3 draws, 73 goals for and 16 against is a pretty sizable number there. They have Falcao, they have Ulk, they have Fernando, they have Jean Moutinho, they have a young James Rodriguez. They're managed by Andre Villas-Boas, who I paused to think about in that moment. I think he then wins the league the next season as well. There is like a Xabi Alonso comparison there, obviously not from the playing standpoint, but a young, up-and-coming, bearded manager with lots of interesting tactical ideas, poised for a move. Andre Villas-Boas makes one, and it does not go well. Xabi Alonso has not yet done that. But I think that would be the closest one aside from Leicester for me from an achievement standpoint. I still think Leverkusen is the most impressive. With everything that's been said and everything I read, I think, to Joe's point, that no team that has done this in the Bundesliga since the 1980s is already incredibly impressive when we're talking about a league that has been so dominated by Bayern in so many different ways, with them winning, like securing the title in March on a few different occasions, for them still to have not done the undefeated thing, at least since 1980, is no small feat. And I think also for Leverkusen, the way they are continuing to win, the way they're continuing to push forward in the DFB Pokal, I think I'm correct in saying they have not yet lost in the Europa League either. Like, they, even though they've advanced, I think they maybe drew one game in the knockout round. I could be wrong there, but they won all of their group stage games. Porto, by comparison, did lose 2 games en route to winning the Europa League. Both of them were essentially when they had already secured the tie, or at least the second leg when they lose to Villarreal 3-2. They won the first leg 5-1. So I get the impression they weren't so focused on that one. But I just think for Leverkusen to be this perennial team that I always think of as being 2-5 is where they're going to finish. For them to have been this dominant, this strong, found ways to win, been comprehensively good, but also been sort of like a plucky fighter on occasion, to have a really interesting manager, to have the talent they do, both in terms of veteran talent and youth, I think it's a pretty compelling argument, and I really like this question from Clay.
Wait, so sorry, Taylor, I've got a question, because I think generally we're all kind of on the same page. Mm-hmm. Are you trying to say that this Leverkusen team is the best in terms of quality, or the best story, or neither?
I think if they were able to achieve what the question proposes, that if they go on to win the Europa League,
sure,
and don't lose a game, and they win the DFB Pokal, I think the achievement is the most impressive achievement for a non-Champions League
team. So more so than Leicester. That's just your opinion.
It's a tough one, and I see where the Leicester one comes in. I do think because they've been successful in a variety of competitions, that pushes them ahead a little bit, and the way they would end up winning it pushes them ahead.
They've not lost a single game in any competition. If they go through the entire season not losing a game, which at this point is like kind of realistic, like they're one of the favorites for the Europa League, they're in the DFB Pokal final against Kaiserslautern, like they they clearly
incredible
have
name
to win
by
that.
The way
I'm really looking forward to that game. Like Kaiserslautern are back, like they're one of the old like teams of German football. They're not back, they're still in like the second tier, but whatever, they're in a big game. But that would make it a difficult choice between Leicester winning the Premier League and Leverkusen going through an entire season. Like if Real Madrid were to do that, or Man City were to do that,
but
the
it's not the same.
Elite.
It's not the same though, right? Like I think that's part of the discussion you can't avoid. I am floored by what Bayer Leverkusen have done. They are one of my favorite teams ever at this point. Taylor was right to hop on the hype train early, and I'm grateful he saved us some seats. It's been a great ride. But you can't compare what Leverkusen are doing this year with. Yeah. I mean, certainly with the Premier League. Like it's just. It is completely impossible.
I mean, Joe, to your point, like the stat that I love so much is that like I think the betting odds for Elvis still being alive were better than the betting odds for Leicester winning the Premier League that season. So I'm assuming
because you put money on it.
Ryan would have tipped Elvis. Every year
since then, Elvis to be still be alive. And what's the office line? Like Brian Adams to win an Oscar. When someone gives you 10,000-1 odds, you got to take them. And in this, I'm assuming Leverkusen had somewhat long odds, but definitely not to that degree. Now, the odds on them going undefeated for an entire season in every single competition, those were probably slightly greater. But Joe, I take your point that the Leicester one, it's really hard to have this conversation when it's between Leicester and Leverkusen, by the way. but I think there is that same vibe of like, surely they're going to lose points at some point. Surely they're going to fall out of the title race. That has to happen. It has to. And it just kept not happening. And for the quality that comes out of that team and was still in that team, even with some of the sales they had, man, that's a tough one. You all have made a compelling argument there that it might be Leicester this season they win the title.
Elvis would be like in his 90s now, wouldn't he? I'm not sure I'm taking that bet.
I just looked it up, and I guess the odds were 2,000-1 that Elvis, you could get these somewhere, that Elvis would resurface in, quote, good health, unquote.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And Leicester were 5,000-1,
I mean,
I think.
Yeah. Don't make that.
That is
don't do that.
Shockingly short.
Right?
Yeah. Well, the real question is, who resurfaces first, Elvis Presley or Andre Villas-Boas? Because both of them have gone missing, as
probably
far as
Elvis.
I can tell.
Elvis, by the way.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Clay, for that question. We go now to Sean Kirkpatrick, who says, what are your thoughts on future USWNT coach Emma Hayes' actions and comments after Chelsea's League Cup final loss to Arsenal? It seems she has a long history of putting her foot in her mouth, says Sean, and being a sore loser, which doesn't make me excited to see her in charge of the USWNT. Now, Joe, the incident that Sean's referring to here was the clash that Emma Hayes had with Arsenal boss Jonas Eidevall after Arsenal's 1-0 victory over Hayes' Chelsea in the Women's League Cup final. She gave him kind of a shove as she went past him at full time. When asked what happened, Hayes says, I'm not down for male aggression on the touchline. I told him this. Eidevall subsequently said he didn't feel comfortable with that label. And apparently the incident, well, perhaps, Joe, why don't you go and talk about the incident and how this happened and your thoughts on it?
Yeah, you set the basic foundation there well, Ryan. So Eidevall said, some of the background here, Eidevall, Arsenal manager, said that there was a dispute surrounding a pregame decision to use either one ball or multiple balls for the match. Now, I learned a lot about how soccer balls are used in the course of doing research for this question. Teams get the choice before the game whether they want to use the same ball the entire time, meaning that the ball kids have to go chase it down and hand it back in, and that's all fine, or if they want to use multiple balls to speed up the game a little bit. Apparently, it was decided that this game would include just the one ball. So as the game was progressing,
Can I jump in really quickly, Joe? From my reading, you can either say we want to use the one or we want to use multiple. If there is a disagreement,
then
the default decision is the one.
Yep.
And I believe I'm correct in saying that Eidevall wanted to use multiple. Emma Hayes wanted to use one, or the, at least Chelsea elected to use one, so they went with one. I think that is correct, and I think that is kind of important.
I'm not quite as confident on that last part, but Idaval, I believe, said something to that effect. Okay. And I haven't heard Emma Hayes or Chelsea comment on that, but it's possible that I missed it. I didn't know any of that stuff, so we're all learning together on today's episode of the Total Soccer Show. So in extra time, Arsenal are up 1-0. It's the 121st minute. Chelsea are in this like last-ditch moment, trying to get a goal to send it to penalties. Chelsea, the ball ends up going out of play, and Chelsea tried to grab a new ball while they're trailing 1-0. They want to get back in play quickly. They need something here very, very quickly. And you can see in that moment, as the ball is out of play, Chelsea are going to grab a new one. You can see Jonas Idaval pointing to the ball that they were using before and how it went out of play like 20 yards to his right. And you can hear him yelling on the broadcast and like see him gesturing, sort of trying to make it clear what has happened. I can't make out what he's saying. Maybe somebody could. Erin Cuthbert then quickly, she's taking the throw-in, tries to grab the new ball and take the throw-in from a little bit further upfield. And Cuthbert is not happy. And Idaval is not happy. The ref blows a whistle and makes Chelsea throw back closer where the original ball actually went out of play. They're still using a new one, but at least it's closer to where the original ball was going out. Idaval is still not pleased. He's not making a move at this point, at least, towards Cuthbert. It looks like he yells at her, though it's possible that he said some stuff he shouldn't have said. I can't make it out. But then Cuthbert walks over to him. He still doesn't make any real moves there. There's something of an exchange, and then play resumes. There were certainly words exchanged. And then after the game, you have Emma Hayes shoving Idaval and inciting male aggression in that moment. I don't think, frankly, that it's right for Emma Hayes to do that. Like, I don't think that's appropriate. It's certainly not especially becoming either to use that word twice on this episode, regardless of what happened on the sidelines. And it's possible, very possible, that stuff happened on the sidelines that shouldn't have. So I'm not saying that there wasn't some sort of grievance. I think that is entirely possible. I don't know. But one thing that I do know, to get to sort of more of the intent behind the question, to set this incident aside, Emma Hayes wears her heart on her sleeve. Like, that has become very, very clear. It's been clear for years now throughout her career in England, even, you know, her early days in the United States as well. She shows that in press conferences. She shows that in her actions. Generally, it seems like something that she has used for good and to motivate her players and to get a lot out of her group at any given time. And to be honest, even though I don't think she comes off great in this instance, I'm really not concerned at all about her leading the U.S.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it there, Joe. For starters, she wouldn't be the only sore loser in world soccer, frankly. And it's good to be competitive on that side of things. I think the two issues I have is I don't think it's ever justified to be violent and had that kind of physical violence, maybe a strong word, but had the physical contact that she did at the end of that game. And I'm kind of, I have an issue with the gendering of the aggression there and whether it's a means of sort of deflecting from the fact that she was aware that she had some bad conduct on her own part at the end of that match. So it's a tricky one, Graham.
Yeah, I think you probably, I agree with everything that Joe said about the way that Emma Hayes is and that broadly being a positive thing. And Jurgen Klopp is one of the sorest losers there is, and he is still an exceptional manager. And sometimes I think having that fire is a good thing, actually. So I'm not worried about that with Hayes at all. She's more than proved herself at this point of her career. I think you probably undermine your point about male aggression if you're the one pushing the other manager after the game. I don't know if Hayes was making a broader comment about some of the male managers in the WSL, but it's difficult to comment on that when we don't have any reporting on that. She hasn't made the case. She didn't elaborate on that. She kind of left the comment hanging a little bit. I like to think on this show that we are forthright in highlighting inappropriate behaviour by coaches in the women's game when it happens and when it's there. Unfortunately, it has been a big storyline these last few years, but I think in this specific incident, it seems to be something of a nothing burger. I'm not too concerned.
Yeah. Taylor, any further thoughts on this one?
Yeah. I thought in the wide angle, I thought it was pretty clear that Idaval was yelling at the fourth official to basically be like, hey, remember we had this rule? There is an alternate angle where he is definitely yelling specifically at the direction of Emma Hayes. I can't tell if he is yelling like, hey, we agreed on the one ball thing. I don't agree that he squared up to Erin Cuthbert. He seems to have squared up to Emma Hayes, and then Cuthbert comes over. That seems to be part of what Emma Hayes was frustrated by, that she felt like he was showing aggression towards her player and to her team. I think I agree with the takeaway. I think it's kind of a nothing burger. It doesn't give me huge concerns. I do think, and this is where I would love to hear what you all think about this, that there is an argument that managing the U.S. women's national team is the biggest job in the women's game, and with it comes the most scrutiny. And you can ponder the way the media covers the U.S. women's national team or sometimes doesn't cover them. And I think that's a fair criticism as well. But it does seem like there is a pretty prominent spotlight on the person who's going to be coaching that team. And there's this moment. There's the quote that I think she now says was kind of taken out of context and kind of overblown about how she doesn't approve of relationships between players in the same team, which is, to my understanding, a fairly common thing in the women's game, both at club level and at national team level. So I think those are two sort of incidents in which maybe the moment hasn't reflected well, or she hasn't reflected well in the moment. And that's the only concern I have, is that if you are then going to be further in the spotlight, you kind of have to deal with those moments of scrutiny and those moments of criticism. And I haven't loved sort of the response to the player relationships one in particular, where she sort of is like, I don't get why people are so bent out of shape about this. Like, they know what I meant. I've spoken to the players. It's not a big deal. And it's not that she hasn't addressed it necessarily. It's just more so that there have been times when she seemed sort of surprised that there was such a response. And I think that's always going to happen when you're a manager, especially a high-profile manager. People are going to take stuff out of context. People are going to blow up quotes or blow up situations, and you have to be able to navigate that. And these two moments, I don't know, I would say she's navigated particularly well. So that is my one slight concern with her going forward.
Well, we've spoken previously about how with international management in particular, your job is beyond football, right? You are there to be a spokesperson for the national game and for a group of players. So I accept that point, Taylor. Those two are recent missteps. I agree the relationship comment as well. I would class that as a misstep. I think they're probably isolated incidents for Emma Hayes, because I take your point that the US job, the pressure on her is going to be at a much higher level than she has at Chelsea. Chelsea is a big job. It's nothing compared to the US job. But Emma Hayes is someone who's used to the spotlight. She does punditry in the UK on men's games, on major tournaments. She's used to having that kind of glare. And I can't really think of any instance before on TV where she's made such a misstep before. So I kind of think, unfortunately, it's just two that have come at quite, quick instances, quick together, close together. I don't really have any concerns that she'll put her foot in her mouth on a regular basis as the US manager. I think it's just unfortunate that these things have happened recently.
I'd agree with that, Graham. I don't think it's a reason not to be excited to see her in charge of the USWNT, as Sean outlines in the question.
It doesn't hurt my enthusiasm for sure. It's just until this moment, she had in my mind like a fully unblemished record. Not that this is even a blemish, but it is just one of those things that then, like, if there's another thing where she says something that gets taken out of context and overblown, like, it easily becomes a spiral cycle. I don't think that will happen here. I'm not really that concerned about it. It's just once you start putting your foot in it from a media perspective, that can get clicks and that can sell papers, and people can really enjoy continuing to report on things like that. I still think this is a nothing burger, this one in particular. I also think I watched the footage of this way too much, like Zapruder film style, like back and to the left. Like, wait, what happened here? What happened there? And I think the other little
enhance.
Yes, exactly. One other little thing that I think is kind of worth noting is just that I think Idaval does not see this coming, does not see her anger coming at all, and is sort of going to be like, hey, good game. And I think he's going for like the handshake hug. And so he's already sort of leaning in. And I think if she is angry and coming at him with like, hey, don't talk to my players like that, and he's kind of leaning into her, I get she's much shorter, obviously. I get the need to be like, whoa, back up for a second. I got things to say to you. And I think that context is kind of important to understanding the shove, because it wasn't like she walked out, gave him like the full on Elaine from Seinfeld shove, knocked him over, and then stood over him and yelled at him. I do think there is a little bit more context to be provided there. Again, don't shove people. Don't lay hands on people. It's not a great idea. I'm raising a toddler. That's a thing we have to keep reinforcing. But overall, I'm not really concerned about this story.
Taylor, Graham's right here. I think at this point he knows that he probably shouldn't shove people. One other thing on the U.S. women's national team. They won the She Believes Cup last night, beating Canada in penalties, which is seemingly a thing that they do to Canada these days. And the next time we see the U.S. gather for a competitive game, or any game, I should say, Emma Hayes will be on the sidelines. So we will get a chance to, like, actually see all this happen, instead of continuing to speculate about how things will go, as we have for months now.
I will say, Joe, the US women's national team are not particularly well liked on the international stage, and having someone of her character
winners never are, baby. Woo!
That's it, Taylor.
You just
that's
said Tommy
it.
After the 2023 World Cup, Taylor.
I hated that and loved it at the same time.
It's the crux of the point, though, Taylor. That's a big reason why they are disliked. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether she has a slightly divisive character, which is quite well suited, in fact, to the mm-hmm. US job.
Yeah. I can see the villain arc continuing for the US Women's National Team, which is honestly something that I think they very much embrace.
Yep.
But we'll see if they can continue to embrace it, because every time that they don't win a trophy or every time that they underperform in back-to-back major tournaments under Vlatko Andonovski, that shine of the villain armor wears off a little bit.
Yeah. Did Jonas Eidevall and Emma Hayes do the Euros together in studio,
together.
Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I remember seeing that last summer. Yeah, just checking. Okay.
They did no pushing happened in the studio.
No, they were in studio for ITV, right?
Oh, okay.
Yep.
They did it together. So they certainly have a relationship.
You said the Euros. Got it. I swear, this is so stupid. I thought you said the Rose, and I thought like they did a duet of the song The Rose from. I was very confused.
You're right,
by
Taylor.
What you
that
said
was.
There.
Yeah, that was.
Yes,
yeah,
it was. I know. But also, the song rules Bette Midler for life.
Just, I mentioned it before, but on her unblemished record, February 2021, AFC Wimbledon offered her the job of manager at AFC Wimbledon. She said it was an insult to women's football that she was offered that job. This was a League One third-tier team in England at the time. I get what she was getting at there, but I read that as a League One team that's forward-thinking, trying to smash a glass ceiling for the women's game there in bringing her in, and she kind of threw it back in Wimbledon's faces a little bit there. So there's another example, maybe the divisiveness that's not going to be a game changer, if you will.
The pushing would have been embraced by Wimbledon. That was basically your identity as a team in the 90s.
That's right. Yeah, it would have fitted in well. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, plenty more questions, including how can 18-year-olds sign contracts? Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Very much just kidding, because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you're connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates, so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Martha Escobar has been in touch and says, how is it that under 18-year-olds can sign contracts? And what happens to the money they earn before they are legal adults? Graham, if an under 18 wants to sign a contract, my understanding is they sign a contract. Is it that simple?
Asked and answered.
So I went through the FIFA regulations on the status and transfers of players. It's a thrilling
Graham, you are a literal war hero. I'm just so proud and thankful for
literal.
I had to read it because Netflix haven't published the adaptation of it yet. So gotcha. I had to go through it every single page. Section 18.2 states that, quote, players under the age of 18 may not sign a professional contract for a term longer than 3 years. And then the other section that I found that mentioned 18-year-olds or underage players was section 19.1, which states that, quote, international transfers of players are only permitted if the player is over the age of 18. Now, we discussed, to provide a peek behind the curtain, we discussed this before we started recording, and so I might not have the full answer, and maybe Taylor and Joe and Ryan can fill in the gaps that I haven't filled in. But I think that essentially means that if you're going from one professional club to another, you can't transfer internationally before the age of 18, but there are certain instances where if you held a passport, or maybe if you were going from an amateur team to a professional team, or if your parents were going to work in another country, then that would be permitted. But I couldn't find anything on that in this FIFA document. In terms of when a player can sign a contract to be paid a full salary, 17 is that age, according to this FIFA document. That's technically the age when a player can become professional, in the way that they use that word. But if we're taking the word professional as getting paid for your work, you can be paid before you're 17. But essentially, in the UK anyway, you need to be on scholarship terms. And that essentially works the same way as any other job, right? When you leave school, you can get an apprenticeship from the age of 16. A lot of my friends did that to become tradespeople. Same deal with football. You can leave school and go on to a scholarship, and that salary is minimal, but you're still getting some form of education at that age. Sometimes the amount of money that you'll receive can be as little as like a few thousand pounds a year. So that is what I found in relation to this question. In terms of what happens to the money, they get paid it just as you would if you're like a 16-year-old leaving school. Like when I did jobs when I was a teenager, I just got paid that money. My parents didn't look after that money. It ends up being used to pay for Nando's. That's essentially where.
What about Grim when you were a 12-year-old bartender? Did you get paid normally for that as well?
I just went straight into the bar, Joe. Just went around the other side of the bar. Smart. As a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Put it in the kitty that way.
No cash required. Excellent.
And when you were a 9-year-old chimney sweep, same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Graham, I suppose if the example that Leo Messi coming from Argentina to Barcelona, was he 11, I think, when he came to Barcelona? And there was that famous story of his father signing a contract on a napkin. Presumably he's getting the money, but it's in a trust or his father's managing it at the very least, right?
Well, I'm not convinced, and this is where my research is maybe letting me down a little bit. I'm not convinced that he would have got paid as an 11-year-old. Yeah. Taylor, you were maybe suggesting that his dad got a job working at Barcelona, well, and that's how he was allowed to come over? Is that
I'm not even sure about that one. I know that there were instances before the rules were changed where you would have players come over at 10, 11, 12, 13, and their parents would be hired as gardeners, let's say, for the club. And so technically, the parents are coming to work. The kid now just happens to be living in the same city so he can play for the academy team. And I do think that is roughly how it worked with Messi. I think also the medical treatments are a part of that conversation. And I think do maybe not provide extenuating circumstances, but at least a little bit more context. I think a key thing there is just that when we're talking about the transfer of professionals, as you said, Graham, you can't do that, international transfers until they're 18?
Yes.
I think the transfer and the registration of the player is the key thing there. If they've been registered as a professional in a league prior to being 18, I think you cannot then transfer them or register them in a new league. Whereas, say, Christian Pulisic, who had not, I guess, signed a pro contract before he moves to Dortmund, has the passport, can move. In Germany, you can sign a professional contract at the age of 16. So he goes there on that passport and is able to play. If he had signed for the Philadelphia Union, let's say, since he's Hershey, Pennsylvania, and played maybe like a couple games for the senior team, then I think he could not have moved after that point because he has technically turned pro, and then you can't internationally transfer past that point. But I think there have long been ways of getting around these types of restrictions, and I think some of those loopholes were closed somewhat recently, and then even more recently, loopholes have again been closed. But I think there are still ways to get players basically to move at a younger age, and that is a positive in some ways, and then also a pretty sizable issue in a lot of ways when it comes to football trafficking. And like Ahmad Diallo, who plays for Manchester United or played for Manchester United, I believe is a trafficked player who was like moved to Italy from Africa and then sort of had to figure it out and didn't really have a ton of support behind him. And so you can get those situations, and I think that's what some of these provisions and protections are meant to limit.
Yeah, it is a scary situation, to be honest, and FIFA have tried to make it more difficult or for those negative instances that you're talking about, Taylor, to happen. They are obviously still happening. As it relates to the question, certainly in the United States, you can sign an MLS contract at, any age, as far as I'm aware. We've never seen a player younger than 14 do that, but Kevin Sullivan, who's 14 years old right now and is a name that is growing in popularity around American soccer, The Athletic reported about this. This is absolutely going to happen. Is going to sign a MLS record rich homegrown deal. Like, he's going to become the richest homegrown signing in MLS history. He's 14 years old. He's going to be with the Union for a couple of years, and eventually he's going to go and move over to Europe with Man City. Like, he's going to get paid. That is just like Graham said earlier. You know, maybe we all weren't professional soccer players. I mean, I think Ryan was at one point, but I don't think the rest of us were. Like, you could be working at a bar or working at, that's a bad example, you could be working at a grocery store or as a waiter or whatever. This, as far as I understand it, works the exact same way.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing a 14-year-old with a Lamborghini tearing up and down.
Can't drive it, but it's just, you know, sort of sitting in the driveway. It looks nice.
Yeah. Being driven by a driver. Wonderful stuff. Martha, thank you very much for that question. We go to Brian Waters now, who says, hello, long-time listener, first-time emailer. Just curious, with the incredible work that Rob Edwards at Luton has done, why isn't he rumoured for bigger and better jobs? They're an incredible story, playing an unexpectedly exciting style of play, especially considering their budget limitations and lack of high-level facilities. Taylor, as we've established, it is canon. Rob Edwards is the hunkiest coach in soccer. Former Wales defender, spent most of his playing career at Wolves, took over at Luton in November 22, went up to the Premier League in his first season, and as Brian says, has done a rather incredible job. There were some of us in the media who thought that Luton might struggle to get points at all this season.
What?
And he's kept them well within contention to actually stay up and maybe even do a sophomore season in the Premier League. So does Rob Edwards-Taylor deserve more credit besides his aesthetic appeal?
I mean, yes, he deserves more credit. I don't know if that means that he should be linked with bigger jobs or make those moves. He deserves plenty of credit for what Luton have done, because I thought they were a club that would be pretty content to be in the Premier League for one season, get that money, drop back down, use that money to reinvest and build infrastructure, and then see if they can come back up and maybe become a more stable Premier League club. So that they have had some of the success they've had is very much to his credit and to the club's credit as a whole. You call him the hunkiest manager in the Premier League. I would say my larger answer to this question is to look at the second hunkiest manager in the Premier League, Sean Dyche, obviously. And I think it's a very similar situation, that he's at Burnley for a very long time. They come up, they get relegated, he stays there, they come back up, he stays there. And I think there is probably an idea of, is he good or is he good for his level? And I think Sean Dyche is a good manager, but I think that is what holds back a lot of clubs. When it's a smaller club who are backs against the wall, scrapping to survive, and they're doing what they can with what resources they have, that can be a really successful story. It can also be really hard to transfer that. That's kind of an intangible thing. I feel like Joe will be in a similar mindset here. It can be hard to take that context or take that manager out of that context, put them in a new situation, and assume that the same will be the case. And so I think with clubs like Luton, with clubs like Burnley, there is oftentimes a need for a longer track record and a more proven resume to even get a move to a lower mid-table Premier League club. I don't think many Premier League clubs are looking at Luton and thinking, yeah, that seems like what Newcastle could use, for example. So I think it's he is doing a really good job for the resources he has, but you have to do that for a few seasons before I think there starts to be a feeling of like, okay, this is actually a permanent thing that can be replicated and isn't just a one-off great Ted Lasso style story.
Yeah, I mean, he's only been in that job at Luton for like, what, a year and a half? He replaces the name of the manager who I've forgotten, who went to Southampton and was really, really bad last season and got them relegated.
Dave
anyway,
Jones?
He replaces... No, not... What's his name? I forgot his name. Anyway.
Steve Luton, I think it was.
Steve Luton, yep, that was it. Nailed it. Is it Nathan Jones?
Nathan Jones. I got the wrong Jones.
Yeah, Nathan Jones. He was terrible. He was hardly at Southampton, so I think we can all be forgiven for forgetting his name. But yeah, he replaces Nathan Jones at Luton in November 2022. And so he's not really been in this job for very long. So I think that's the main reason why he hasn't been given an opportunity higher up, because he's not been in that job for long. Before that, he was at Forest Green Rovers and in a very short-lived spell at Watford. A lot of managers have had a short-lived spell at Watford in recent years. So people are clearly looking at him. Like, there has been a progression there from Forest Green to Watford to Luton. I think opportunities will come his way if he continues on this trajectory, if only because of the social media impressions and how thirsty Twitter is for him. But he's done an incredible job. Just to outline how well Luton are playing right now, I've spoken about their budget before. They started the season with a budget that would have been the lowest in the Championship, never mind the Premier League. I think that's changed with some of the new contracts they've given out and some of the signings they've made over the season, but they're still punching well above their weight with the smallest budget in the Premier League. And Rob Edwards has given that team an identity, a clear way of playing. It took him a little while to figure it out. Luton didn't play the way they do now last season, but Edwards recognised the need to adapt, and Luton are now dangerous on the counter. They play with physicality, they get the ball forward quickly, and they roll with the punches, sometimes a little bit too freely with some of the matches that they're involved in. They're always entertaining and they seem to be on the wrong end of a lot of thrilling scorelines, but nonetheless they're competitive, and he's maximising the talent in that squad. He's settled on this 3-4-2-1 shape that is getting the most out of a lot of players that, frankly, I didn't think had this sort of level in them. Alfie Doughty has been very impressive this season in the left wing-back role. Ross Barkley has been a revelation in a slightly deeper role in midfield where he can dictate things ahead of him. Of course, that's a slightly different position for him. We haven't seen him play that way. And then guys like Andros Townsend, who was doing punditry work for the first half of the season and kind of looked retired.
He was on a weekly deal, wasn't he, at the start of the season?
Yeah, well, he might still be on a weekly deal, but he's performing well, and Ogbeni's the other attacking wide player, although they come inside and play into Carlton Morris, who, by the way, Carlton Morris is a complete battering ram of a centre-forward, who, again, I didn't think he'd be able to make the step up to the Premier League, but has been very, very effective. So they've got a clarity of what they stand for and how they play, and without that, I think Luton would be doomed on the basis of their individual talent. And this is where I know we've had a lot of discussions recently about the impact of managers and how much of a difference that they make. I think Rob Edwards has made a massive difference on this Luton Town squad due to the reasons that I've just mentioned with identity and giving them a clear way of playing. I think they'd be doomed without him and without that.
That, listener, is a very impressive endorsement given Graham's massive anti-Welsh agenda. So very pleased with you putting that one out. Joe, anything further to add on this one?
Not a ton other than what's already been said. I think it's hard a little bit to build a great narrative around any individual attached to a team that's still probably going to get relegated, and Luton are still very much at risk of being relegated. Not guaranteed. You know, it could be Forest instead. We'll see. But it still might be Luton, and it's just really hard to build a really good story about a manager or a team when that's happening, right or wrong, by the way. And I think there are reasons why folks should be excited about what Rob Edwards and Luton Town are building. I think Graham referenced this. I'm also not totally sure that it's sunk in how small Luton's budget has been. Maybe isn't quite right now. It is still, according to the salary data I could find, which always needs to be taken with a grain of salt, still the lowest wage bill in the Premier League. But I mean, I don't really know that the early stages quite sit in for people when we think about how different Luton Town are to the rest of the teams in England in the top tier. So, I don't know. I think those things are very real factors, but I'm not sure how this narrative will progress if Luton Town go down.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian, for that question. One more quick question to squeeze in this episode from Robert Cordova, who asks, what concerns, if any, does Total Soccer Show have about Fox's coverage of Euro 2024 this summer? Now, Taylor, ESPN have long had the rights to the Euros and, by all accounts, been doing a pretty good job over the last few tournaments. Fox have got the rights for this tournament and for Euro 2028 as well, games being shown across Fox's network. I'm pretty ambivalent about this because as long as they show the games and they're not interrupted and there's no blackouts or anything, fine, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think what concerns do I have? None, because I know what my expectations are for Fox. I think the only major concern I have is, will they have the tactical cam that ESPN often has for the Euros and for major tournaments where you can see from like high up and behind the goal so you can see what everybody's doing? I would like Fox to have that. But, I mean, I think we know what their coverage is going to be. We know how they're going to cover it. It's going to be hot takes and big talking points. And was that a penalty? Of course it was a penalty. No, it wasn't a penalty. And, I mean, that's what we've come to expect. And so I think that's what it will be. I don't know how much say what you will about Stalin type coverage we're going to get from Fox, but I'm sure there'll be a little bit of that peppered in. So overall, my expectations are that it will be a tournament that Fox covers.
That is definitely going to be a thing that happens in the coming months. Joe, any further thoughts on Fox's coverage? Right.
I sort of align with what's already been said. I have lots of thoughts on like sort of the soccer discussions or maybe lack thereof that happen. I don't think that's just a Fox problem, to be honest. Like that's my general thesis with the soccer narrative and
also,
how
the
sport is covered on TV and frankly in writing as well. And that's why I'm thankful that we can have at times larger, you know, tactical conversations about games and dig into like some more things that are like relevant to how games are won and lost in a way that it's just, it's harder to do on TV because you oftentimes don't have a lot of time and you do need to get stuck into some of the bigger, more narrative-y talking points. And so I'm not saying that it's easy to do those things well on TV. I still think we have a long way to go when it comes to some of those conversations and how they happen and the fact that they don't happen enough. But I don't really have any major concerns.
Joe, I think that's a very charitable and fair point that like we can do what we do because we have an hour plus of time to talk about
as much
games
we have as much time
about.
As we want realistically exactly. Like as much time as listeners will give us, and they are gracious to give us a lot.
And we don't have a producer in our ear saying, move us along, get to this point, get to this talking point. And I think we don't have a ton of commercials that we have to cram in. We have a few commercials to cram in, but not nearly
wrap
as
up,
many
Taylor.
As a Fox
One
broadcast
minute,
does. and I also think from talking to people at Fox that there is a feeling, rightly or wrongly, that if you're trying to pull in the biggest audience possible, a generic sports viewing audience might not want to get into the weeds on tactics, but they might want to know, why isn't Messi playing at the Euros? Or, you know, like, who's the best team? Who's the best player? Why, like, should this have been a goal? Should that not have been a goal? Like, I think they gear their coverage towards pulling in the biggest audience they can, and that's the style they want to go for. It's the not the style I wish they went for, but it's what they've done in the past, so it's what I expect them to do again this year.
Good stuff. Graham, any reason why I shouldn't VPN and watch the BBC coverage? No commercials, I suppose, is the main benefit of BBC coverage.
Yeah, that is the main benefit. This discussion is kind of alien to British football viewers because it's just every major tournament is just BBC and ITV. Like, do they even... I presume they must. The rights must be up for tender at some point, but my entire life it's been shared between BBC and ITV, every single major tournament, including the women's games, so yeah. And the women's World Cup and stuff, so... Yeah, we don't really have this to-ing and fro-ing between different broadcasters. Obviously, I'm not so familiar with Fox's coverage, but we were together for the 2022 World Cup, and I caught a lot of it then. I remember being shocked at how much of it felt like a commercial for Qatar. I know we all remember Mr. Q, the infamous Mr. Q, but even a lot of the segments felt like the audience was being sold on Qatar all the time, so I don't know if we're going to get... Mr. G or something for the Euros this summer, and Alexi Lalas driving around in a Volkswagen or what. But that would be my one one of my biggest concerns, I mean, with Fox, as it feels like during the last World Cup, it felt like one big commercial a lot of the time.
I think that is part of it, though, like because it's Germany. I don't know. I'm not sure how controversial that can get. I mean, I guess somewhat, but not really. Whereas, like, yeah, if this were being hosted in Hungary, I would have more concerns about how Fox is going to cover it and the glory to the Hungarian government that we would be getting in the coverage.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
The most impressive thing about the Fox coverage of the last World Cup I found was the set right on the waterfront in Doha. So
they'll do that again.
I don't know whether we're going to get something for like overlooking the Brandenburg Gate or
that for sure. Yeah. It'll be.
I wonder if Fox will have something similar. Mm-hmm.
That is part of their philosophy, I think, is to have the biggest set in the most like high profile area. Like they had it in Red Square, I think, in 2018 for the World Cup. Like I think that is part of their philosophy and identity. So I would be shocked if the Brandenburg Gate is not somewhere in there.
It is indeed. The Lederhosen budget is going to be through the roof, I imagine, for that set.
Stuart Holden is going to be in Lederhosen the whole tournament, isn't he?
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Thank you very much, Robert, for that question. And indeed to everybody who has asked a question on this episode. One more time, patreon.com/totalsoccershow if you would like to support us. Thank you very much indeed. But for now, Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much for your contribs.
My pleasure, my friend. Thank you for hosting.
Thank you very much, Graham Ruthven.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Joe Lowry. Thanks.
Thanks.
And listener, thank you the mostest. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, thanks. You gotta slice it.